drink the same beer twice in a row. In fact, Frank, even on his website, has highlighted a trip to Leinenkugel's in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Actually, Frank is a Minnesota native raised in a small rural town. One of 10 children. His father had a unique way of naming his children. He decided to do them in alphabetical order. So that would make you number 6.
I am.
Yeah, how about that? My math is good. So from A through?
J.
J. He labeled everything, Frank says, my dad. Even the towel bar in the bathroom had towel bar on it. And made Frank wonder if there were really some small people who crept into their house and did chin-ups on it. Because obviously there was a necessity of labeling it, which implied that it had another use. Another factoid about Frank. His uncle, a Chicago priest, wrote the book that was the basis for the movie The Exorcist. Is it any wonder Frank likes beer? That was your uncle was in Chicago, right?
Great uncle, yep.
Yeah, great uncle. I'm sorry. Well, he must have been a great uncle.
Yes, yep.
He was. Speaking of Chicago, I had to sneak that in here because otherwise my next line didn't work.
Okay.
Betty Brandt Pasek, sitting immediately to my left. Her books are centered in Iowa, but the story of her first book, is it your first book, Gangsters Among Us? Gangsters in Our Midst, I'm sorry, really revolves around events in Chicago during Prohibition and the battles of the Chicago gangs to control liquor and all sorts of vice. Betty was born and raised in a small town of Fairbanks, Iowa, and under a pseudonym, that is the center of where your stories start. She's a retired executive from a Fortune 500 company and a grandmother who now spends her time as a teacher, educational speaker, and writer. She is also a recent winner of the 2025 Editor's Choice Award of Literary Excellence. Ooh. From Reader's House magazine in the UK. There you have it, folks. What could be better? We have a grandma who writes about gangsters and a psychologist who likes beer. Give a warm welcome to Frank Weber and Betty Brandt Pasek.
I thought we would start off, Frank, by each of us telling how we got into this wonderful work of writing books. You go first.
Okay. I just think no matter what you do, you have to have a sense of humor and you have to have a way to vent. Maybe I'll start with a humorous story first. I got 5 granddaughters, just had a grandson. So my job at the baptism for the son was to sit with my 5-year-old granddaughter and keep her under control. That should be easy, right? So the priest is up there with parents and the boy. He keeps getting lost and starting over. And finally, my granddaughter stands up and yells, "This is taking too long. You're wasting my whole day." Everybody who was at the baptism said, she was right. But she was over the next week and she's saying, "Papa, had to do a little time out for baptism." I got into writing because what do? You know, I spend my day talking to a serial rapist, especially when the kids were little. You can't come home to your wife and kids and say, "Hey, guess what I did today?" You know, you traumatize everybody in the family. So I just started writing. I like a good murder mystery. Then I had a bunch of true cases and started writing them and putting them in 3-ring binders in the closet. And I did that for over a decade. And then I started thinking, I feel like I'm getting kind of good at it. And then you think about it, is this just self-delusion? Because it's just my opinion about me. You know, I haven't shared it with anybody. I sent my first book, murder book, to a publisher, and it took off from there. So I've been very fortunate. How about you? How did you get into it?
Well, I was a 9-year-old little girl growing up in this little town of Fairbank, Iowa. For whatever reason, I started telling people, anybody who would listen, that when I grow up, I'm going to write books. We moved into this town from the farm in the mid-1950s. Within a day, a neighbor stopped by to welcome us to the community. He said, "By the way, the town has a gangster." Well, that stuck with me all these years. I've talked with many Fairbank citizens over the years about this gangster. I learned that he was bookkeeper to Al Capone. I've heard many people claim they were bodyguards, or they drove his car, or they distributed his booze. But this was the first time I'd heard someone claimed to be his bookkeeper. So now you have to fast forward to almost 100 years from the date that this gangster first came to my town. I retired 10 years ago, and at the top of my list was to research this guy. His name was Louis LaCava, and see if what he claimed, what he had told the people in my hometown, whether it was fact or fiction. Turned out it was pretty darn easy. I went to Google. Up popped his testimony at Al Capone's 1931 trial on tax evasion. And he had been subpoenaed by the federal government after hiding out for 2 years in Cleveland. Why hadn't anybody else written this story before, I wondered, as I continued to do research, really what quite a story I found.
Very good. So what made you decide to write in this genre, out of curiosity?
Well, I call it historical fiction because historical fiction is a true story, and there are pieces of it you don't know. So you have to use creative license to fill in between the blanks. I could have also called it creative nonfiction, and in some regards, I wish I had done that. I think some institutions would be more favorable to carrying my books. One sounds more historically accurate than the other. So live and learn. You make mistakes along the way. I tell true crime, historical true crime, mm-hmm. but there's also quite a bit of fiction in it. For example, it's easy enough to recall the stories I found in the newspapers about Louis LaCava. He's a Catholic, as all Italians are. It's another thing to send him to the priest for confession. I mean, obviously, I hope the reader knows I wasn't in that. I wasn't there with him and the priest, and I overheard any of the conversation, so that's the fictional license I had to take with it. So, Frank, tell me about your weirdest interview.
I do a lot of weird interviews. I've been to every prison in the state, almost every jail in the state. Probably one of the weirdest was in St. Cloud Prison. This particular time I was in there, and they kept bringing me downstairs till I was in a basement that was solid cement. The floor, the walls, the ceiling. And the only thing in the room was two plastic chairs, and in between them, a metal plate bolted into a floor about 4 foot square with a chain coming off it that I could pull a car with. They said, have a seat. We're going to bring in the guy you're going to interview. I was thinking, what is going on here? So I sit down. They bring this guy in an orange jumpsuit. He's got shackles on his wrists and feet. They sit him in a chair across from me. They take that chain, they wrap it around his shackles, and they put six master locks in it. And they said, okay, are you comfortable interviewing him now? And I said, well, I got him on two rape charges. Typically, I do that interview. He wouldn't even be handcuffed. They said, well, he killed a gang member last night. And I said, well, I guess I'm comfortable interviewing him like this. And so we spent the afternoon talking.
Wow. I have nothing to compare that to. Bob, I think it's time for me to leave. So I write about gangsters, but, you know, I'm this, still in my heart, I'm this little 9-year-old girl from Iowa who didn't know what a gangster was, and the thought of a gangster really was pretty daunting to me. And so how was I going to write about him? But how was I going to get inside his head, more importantly? So I had to find out about who Louis LaCava was. Early on, I called family members in Iowa, a couple that I used to babysit for in high school. So first of all, when you call somebody you haven't talked to in 50 years, you have to reintroduce yourself. I said, hello, this is Betty Brandt Pasek, because he knew me by Betty Brandt. And I said, you never told me when I was babysitting for you all those years that you had a great uncle, Louis LaCava, who was part of a mafia family out of Manhattan. So there was this pregnant pause, and finally he said, oh, you've been talking to the people in our hometown of Fairbank. He said, they have nothing better to do than sit around at coffee while they're playing cards, and they manifest these wonderful stories about people that they don't really know very well. Well, Louis LaCava had lived in this town by then. When I made this call, he's obviously deceased, but he had lived in this town with his wife for 60 years. And he said, anything you've heard about Louis LaCava working for Al Capone or being part of a mafia family is all myth. So I hung up the phone feeling pretty dissuaded, pretty discouraged that my great idea for a first novel wasn't going to happen. They're probably, you can't write a story if the story isn't factual unless you really want to get very creative. I really wanted to tell a true story.
Well, and I want to comment on this because we're all about stories, every one of us. I mean, and that's where I kind of started with my writing, that just from working with investigators and you sit around, you're having coffee and you're talking about stuff, and pretty soon you get into story about a case. And then I'd research and it either would get more interesting or less interesting, and that would lead me to writing about it. My last two books, Scandal of Vandals and The Sun, were actually about the T. Eugene Thompson homicide that happened back in the 60s in the metro area. And their son, Jeff Thompson, who's now a judge, is the one who approached me about writing the story. So as we had a number of conversations about it. And the more I got into it, the more I thought, this is a great story. It's just like, so he's having an affair with his secretary. He's having an affair with his law clerk. He has his wife insured for an equivalent of $10 million today. But he takes her on vacation, and everybody who saw him said they're in love, claims he changed his mind. Both him and his wife and their best friend all went to McAllister together. He marries into the Minneapolis Combination, which is the Minnesota Mafia, after college, and kills somebody, gets Roan for an attorney, or gets a, I refer to him as Tug in the book, T. Eugene, and for an attorney who gets him off on a technicality, and they swear there's going to be some retribution for this, and this is right before Deb's murder, the wife's murder. In addition, there's just a variety of things that happened. Tug had defended an individual who killed his family at 16. He got four life sentences, but was allowed to serve them concurrently. Back then, a life sentence was 30 years, 20 years with good time. So at 36, he's released from prison. This guy was released right before this also. And that's why I called it Scandal of Vandals initially, because once you start reading and the true stories of the characters are just all kinds of unsavory characters truly involved in the story. But as I got talking to him, I said, I want to write this in the modern era because I have a series with the same investigator and I want to keep going with it. And I just think it would be interesting, but keeping all the facts of the case accurate. And so I gave him the book after it was written, and he loved it and said, nailed the characters. And so the Scandal of Vandals and The Sun are actually all the same characters. One ends with a conviction. One begins with an appeal. They're just a lot of fun. They were very interesting to me. The more I got into them, the more interesting it became. And again, it's true crime and it's fiction. And this is why, because I didn't want to write a documentary. And so you have to assume some conversations took place that you don't have recorded. I love a good mystery. And I love it when you're going along and the reader has a chance to solve it and you question some things. And it's logical. When you get to the end, it makes sense. Although a lot of people say, I didn't think of it that way. But when I got to the end, I thought, ooh, I should have solved that.
We'll be back for more Masters of Mystery after a word from our sponsors.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Barrio. Senator Tammy Baldwin presses EPA head Lee Zeldin on Great Lakes funding at a hearing on Capitol Hill. The exchange came just 1 week after Clean Wisconsin, the Healing Our Waters Coalition, and Alliance for the Great Lakes met with Baldwin to stress the importance of fully funding the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Zeldin ended up going on record saying the protections would be funded. Wisconsin's muskie season is here. Northern muskie season opens May 24th and runs through the end of the year. This is the 70th anniversary of the muskellunge being proclaimed our official state fish back in 1955. The biggest muskie ever caught was in 1949 near Hayward, weighing in at more than 69 pounds. Knowledge is power. For a deep dive into Wisconsin's environmental issues, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Have you ever found yourself asking,
what's a good recipe for cookies my kids will love?
How do I avoid giving my guests food poisoning?
How would a restaurant chef prepare this meal?
If so, then tune into The Kitchen's Open, the show within the morning show each Monday morning at the start of the 10 o'clock hour. I'll tackle topics, teach techniques, or tell you what to do or not to do when it comes to cooking or the kitchen. I'll also bring you interviews with local chefs and restaurant owners. The Kitchen's Open. We'll tell you something good.
It's no mystery where you find the best munchies. It's under the Old Dutch windmill at your favorite snack store. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or reading your favorite mystery, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back, sleuths and savants. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
How do you decide which stories to write about?
Interest, primarily. Like my book, Burning Bridges. I didn't have a good story at the time, and an investigator walked into my office and said, read your first four books, loved them. I got a great murder mystery for you. Here's all the interviews. Put two boxes of evidence on my desk. And it's about a psychopath who lived in St. Cloud. And what's funny, his criminal history was just so bizarre. Betty and I had talked about this. You get comments, well, that couldn't have happened. Okay, well, it did happen.
So I came across a lot of stories, too. So I write historical fiction, so they happened a long time ago, so there's no way I get to personally interview anybody. Mm-hmm. So I find these stories in newspapers, FBI documents. I interviewed about a dozen people from my hometown who knew Louis LaCava personally, and they told me their stories. They were just young children when he came to town. They also relayed the stories that they'd overheard their parents talk about when they were growing up. The thing about Louis LaCava was, you have to understand a little bit about the mafia world. One of the rules was that you didn't shoot if there were children or women near you. So one of the craziest things this Louis LaCava did was he would invite any child in my hometown to the opera house on Saturday night to see a silent movie at first and then a talkie. And anybody who wanted to go, he'd pay the 10 cents to get in. And then the craziest thing happened. He plunked himself down right in the middle of them. They were adults before they figured out that they were being used as his protection should somebody follow him from Chicago. So those are the much less interesting stories, I suppose. But nonetheless, fun stories that I got from my hometown locals about what it was really like to have Louis LaCava living in their midst for 60 years. I say it's tantamount to having a drug house open up two doors down from your house. Mm-hmm. And the worry that, and they did, they worried about what was going to happen, that someone was going to follow him to town.
It's interesting, though, because it has, there's two sides to that. Like Roan, who's in the Minnesota Mafia, that he had, somebody tried to steal his car and he shot and killed him. And one of their neighbors said, when they were getting interviewed, nobody steals a car in our neighborhood.
No, we really didn't have any big shootouts that ever did happen in my hometown. Mm-hmm. Everything that happened in Chicago or wherever Louis LaCava was and the rest of the hoodlums. So the hardest part for me was to prove that Louis LaCava was Al Capone's bookkeeper, and I've already done that. But then it was, how did I find all the characters that were in his inner circle? Because most people used aliases. So I thought, oh, this was pretty daunting. So I have 29 characters in this book, many of whom are real people who were part of his outfit. And the people I decided to use in this book were people that were written up over and over and again for being in police reports, newspaper reports, for being arrested and investigated regarding crimes that were believed originating from the Capone organization.
Well, and it's interesting because talk about the Minnesota Mafia. I think it, I'm trying to remember if it's in, I think Scandal of Vandals, where there's a scene in the Wabasha Caves, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with the history of there. So that was initially a salt mine, and then somebody, an Italian individual, I think it was, grew mushrooms there. And when Prohibition hit, then the Mafia took it over and made it like a big speakeasy, and they had a casino and restaurant and bars. There was actually a shooting in there. A waitress had heard a Tommy gun popping. She comes out, there's three guys dead sitting around a table with poker chips in front of them. So she calls the police. They tell her, step outside. And the St. Paul police had a policy. They wouldn't touch mobsters as long as you didn't kill people in St. Paul. So all of the biggest mobsters in the world were in those Wabasha caves coming in and flying out again. And so after 2 hours, they come back to her and tell her, we just want to tell you, if you say any more about this, you're going to jail for reporting a false crime. And she steps back in there. The whole place was cleaned up. And you till this to this day, you can see the bullet holes in the wall. But they believe that the bodies are buried somewhere in the caves. Yeah. And so there's a lot. There's some interesting history with that. Back then, the St. Paul police were known to carry an extra uniform to crime scenes instead, in case they had to get a mob member out.
I have a question. Yes. That is a segue away from the mob and your books.
Yep.
You're both from families of 10. We have established your number 6, Frank.
Right.
Betty?
Number three.
So my question really
is... I got to boss a lot of people around.
Is the fact that there were so many kids in your house, it was hard to get a word in edgewise, so you turned to writing? I'd like to hear your comment on that.
Well, there's a couple things of that. I grew up in poverty, and but a great family. Nothing, you know, we had good work ethic, love, you know, it was all good. But by the way, we're all terrible with money. That of all the 10 kids, their spouse handles the money in every marriage. You'd think growing up in poverty, you'd be good at managing money, but there was no money to manage. You know, that basically you're broke. If you had a little extra, you had a party, and then you're broke again. We're a pretty social family. So part of that is you grow up interacting with a lot of people. And all of us, you know, went into a variety, like me as a psychologist and then teachers and a variety of things, yeah. Maybe curiosity. I think education was a big piece. My dad had an 8th grade education, but my mom had a master's degree. So, and she really pushed education. How about you, Betty?
So I'm the third child. So there were 2 boys, me, 2 boys, my sister, and 2 boys. It's still really hard when we get together in August for a sibling reunion. My brothers still do all the talking. I hardly get a word in. Yeah, we grew up very, I guess you would call it impoverished, although we really didn't know it at the time. We had a lot of fun growing up on the farm. I was on the farm for 9 years and then in town, and then I followed those brothers around everywhere they'd let me follow them. I figured out when they just disappeared about age 15, they were doing things they didn't think I ought to be doing with them. And it involved beer and cars and girls, probably. But I was already in my head writing stories, thinking about stories, and recording every dang thing they did, actually.
So did you ever write a book about your brothers?
I did. So when I retired from 3M 10 years ago, with the plan, this dream of this little 9-year-old girl still fervently in my head, I decided I was going to write a book, my first book. I finally had time to do it. I don't know how many of you have planned to do something your whole life, and then the first day you can do it, it dawns on you. You don't have a clue if you know how to do it. So I thought I would write our family's history. I would go back just to my grandparents, because we really didn't know. We spent a lot of time with them, had great fun with them, but we really didn't know where they came from. So I thought I could do this in 30 days. 5 years later, I went down a lot of wormholes, and I wrote a book about our family called We Are 8, A Memoriam, and I got to tell lots of stories about those nasty brothers of mine.
How about you, Frank?
Well, what's sort of funny about this is because the main investigator in my books, has a brother with schizophrenia. My brothers are asking, which one of them is us? One thing, I did grow up with a brother with a disability. I know what it's like to keep from being bullied. And schizophrenia is so bizarre because you have what seems to be a normal conversation. It takes this weird turn. Like one schizophrenic individual was telling me, hey, have you ever heard the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink? I said, I have. He said, that's exactly what my life is like, but there's no horse. I said, I hate to ask, is there water? No. But other than that, it's a great analogy. I've included more true stuff about conversations with my mom, and just because I think they were funny conversations. Maybe she doesn't. Like in my newest book, there's a conversation that I had, because it starts out a couple decades ago, and then it comes more than a couple decades ago and comes back to the current time, where my mom was trying to talk me into going out with this girl, and I wasn't interested in going out with her. And I said, isn't she my cousin? She says, well, second cousin. I said, well, I'm not interested. And then she goes on and on about what a saint she is. And then I'm not saying anything. She says, what are you thinking? And I said, what do you think the consequences are for knocking up a saint? She says, that is not funny. I think that's a little funny. But with all that, I like to include some of the true stuff, good and bad. Like you'll also find in the book that I found out my mom was dying when I was testifying on the stand in court in a case. And that's in the book also.
I don't think I have anything, maybe pieces of Louis LaCava I built into his personality based on my oldest brother. Maybe if I was honest, I'd say that, yeah. But no, not really. It's really about the gangsters who lived in our area. You know, we were talking a little bit about the crimes that you've encountered or tried to resolve, the people you've met. Near my hometown of Fairbank is a small community called Old Wine. Used to be a Chicago Great Western Railway hub. 1,500 miles of tracks, I think, so it was really big. And it had a large, you know what happens when the railroads were being built? The people who built the railroads in the United States were lots of times Italians because they couldn't get work anywhere else. So my husband is from Old Wine, so if he seems gangsterish, you know, it's from hanging out with those Italians. But in 1919, there were several horrific murders that happened there. Allegedly, the Black Hand operated. Do you all know what the Black Hand gang is? Apparently, if you were targeted to be hit, you were notified beforehand. Somebody put something black on their hand and put it on your door, and if you had a black hand show up on your front door, you knew your hours and days and weeks were numbered. And so this Black Hand gang operated in Old Wine. In 1919, a woman is recorded as being strangled in her home, dragged down the street, across the railroad tracks, and her body was dumped in the same place that a man a year earlier had been assassinated in the town.
We'll be back after a word from your local station.
This is the Chef of Love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and shared its overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to start my first culinary business at 16 years old, and inspiration to donate the extra food in my community. Through my life, I've developed an appetite to work with others to ensure everyone has access to the nutritious food we need to thrive. Together, we can help end hunger. Come on, join the movement with Feeding America by volunteering, donating, and advocating. Learn more at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ag Council.
Mornings on WFHR.
Nutella just announced its first new U.S. flavor in 61 years. The new flavor is peanut.
I could just see the boardroom, right, when they were doing this thing.
Oh, gentlemen, we have cornered the market on hazelnut and chocolate. We need something new.
Sir, how about we do peanuts?
Are you telling me you want to do something like peanut butter? That sounds revolutionary.
Brilliant!
Weekday mornings from 9 to 11.
Potato chips, kettle chips, ripple chips, or maybe popcorn, or puffcorn or pretzels. Old Dutch makes them, and a whole lot more. Your snack cravings can be satisfied by grabbing a bag, box, or jar of your favorite at your favorite store. Just look for the Old Dutch windmill. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a holiday gathering or lounging at the beach, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
One of the things I like to include in all my books is a new investigative technique that people aren't familiar with because there's so many neat things. Like if you watch a show on TV and they use thermal imaging, you see those blobs kind of moving around. And in the black and blue, I address this. The FBI has wonderful thermal imaging. They can sit outside your house without seeing anybody. And not only can they tell you how many people are in the house, they can tell you who they are. Their thermal imaging has facial recognition. Yeah, and so there's amazing stuff. And I talk a little in a book I'm actually writing now about geofencing. I don't know if any of you have heard about it. From a satellite, they could zoom in on an area the size of your house, find out all the cell phones that entered that building throughout the day, which is great, particularly if you didn't have a suspect. But it got overused, and so 35,000 geofencing warrants were implemented in 2023. Google said, we're not doing it anymore. We don't make any money on it. That's not our intention. They helped support somebody who got caught robbing a Fairfield Inn, went in at gunpoint, robbed it, left. The Fairfield Inn allowed them to get a geofencing warrant. They saw this person's cell phone, walked in right before the robbery, walked out right after. His attorney argued it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Now, the Fourth Amendment says in a subpoena, you got to identify the person. And what they're saying is it's a fishing expedition, kind of like allowing police just to go randomly search houses. And so you can no longer use geofencing warrants in Minnesota. And so Google refusing to work with the FBI and the CIA is interesting because now the FBI and the CIA contract with the Israeli company called Cellebrite to get that information, and we can't use it in local investigations. I just think, I get it. We don't want people abusing that. But I think if a crime happens in your house, you should have the right to say, I want to see the cell phones that entered, you know, and now you can't. One more comment about cell phones. Use more than anything investigations today because we carry them around all the time. They're bouncing off towers. You can find the location of an Android phone at any point in history. They've used Android phones to show that somebody was at the site, where a body was dropped off, when a body was dropped off. The new iPhones you can trace even when they're off. And it's sort of funny when I'm talking about this, sometimes a large audience, I see people shutting their phones off. And I tell people, unless you plan on killing someone, leave your phone on. Because remember, everything that proves people guilty also proves people innocent, you know?
But Frank, I wonder if you ever Google somebody and find out information.
Well, you can. It's not usable.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So let me ask this. So what are some of the difficulties you've run into as a writer?
Family. Well, you can imagine. Let's say I'm writing about you. I'm look at, she's quivering already. So when I told you earlier, I made this phone call to a man who was the great nephew of Louis LaCava, and he said to me, "You're going down a rabbit hole. There's no truth to Louis LaCava being a member of anything other. He was a Chicago, or he was a Manhattan cigar salesman. He's the person who created that little metal ring around the center of a cigar. He said he's got a patent on that. And he said, I have his retirement certificate after 60 years with the same company. He said, that's what he did with his life. So when I found out who Louis LaCava really was, that his family in Chicago was listed in the who's who in organized crime in Chicago during Prohibition, I made what I call a courtesy call to the family and said, "This is me again. I just want to let you know that if someone was writing a book about my family, I would appreciate a phone call and that someone would explain to me what the story is that's going to be told in this book." I said, I have found information that makes this a really compelling story to tell and to read. Would you like to know some of the things that I found?" And the man said, "No, I don't want to know." And then he handed the phone to his wife, and she was very upset with me for writing this book. And she asked me why I was doing this. And I said, "Well, I know that you don't know this story, apparently, and neither did I. But the fact remains that enough people have told me that he went around the town and told people that he was Louis LaCava's bookkeeper that I thought it warranted looking into and to see if there was a story here. I mean, it's a big story. Mm-hmm. If someone in your small town has been living there undiscovered for 60 years and he's doing other things when he leaves the town." Mm-hmm. And so she finally asked me what I had found. I told her a couple of things. It didn't really make her very happy. So, Frank, how do you decide?
Well,
stories you can tell and how upsetting they're going to be?
I find a good story, and I kind of go with it. That I double check with people. Like, for example, last call, I counseled the victim in that story, and she wanted the story told with her name changed. And there's actually real people I've used in my books with their permission, and they're good with that. So I make sure from those people I have the permission. Sometimes people like in Billy Blaze, when you're dealing with a psychopath, I don't really care what he thinks about it. That I think it's true. It's in the criminal reports. I think that people are entitled to find out. I'm just going to go a little further with this. That one of the things people ask me, I just think of questions people might have, is, why do people kill other people? More often than not, it's narcissistic injury. It's someone who's really self-centered, who can't get over it. You can't break up with me, you can't fire me, that level of self-centeredness. In Greek mythology, Narcissus was someone who fell in love with his image in the pond and drowns in it because he was so enamored with it. So someone who's narcissistic is very self-centered. And I was doing an assessment on a level 3 offender, and I gave him that diagnosis, narcissistic personality disorder. And he comes back a week later and says, "Well, Frank," he says, "I know you think I'm narcissistic, but I've just never been in a room before where I wasn't the smartest and best-looking person." And I'm thinking, nailed that diagnosis. And he's thinking, this is just the reality of my life. Why is that a problem? And so, I love using some of that stuff, too, you know, that.
And how do you write so that you protect as much as you can the innocent? Because people are going to recognize these stories. There are going to be people.
That's true. I sometimes will change the names or change communities, but I keep the facts of the story the same. I use real communities because I use real places. I know Bob was giving me grief about beer. I do like beer, but I don't drink it all the time. One of the things I like about tap rooms is they're one of the few places in the community that actually makes what they sell, you know? And I like that. I like a throwback to old places and restaurants, and that's what I like. And, you know, I get tired of franchises and all that stuff. So I like kind of giving them a shout out in my books about, okay, he stopped in here and I thought this was a pretty good beer. And so I enjoy that.
So I used, as I said, in Gangster in Our Midst, I have 29 characters. About half of them, maybe a third, are people from my hometown. I used real names. I've gotten more comments from people who were upset that I didn't use the real name of the town marshal. His real name was Bill Hahn. He was the town marshal for 33 years. during most all of that, during the time that this Louis LaCava was in town. The reason people are upset with me is because I changed his name to Sweeney. But I did that because I needed an Irishman to tell a piece of the story. The Irish and the Italians were the last to come to America. And there were a lot of Irish people living in this town. And if I was going to tell a true story, I had to include at least a piece of their story. So this brown-eyed, brown-haired, tall, lanky man, I turned into a red-headed, blue-eyed, lanky man and called him Sweeney Delaney, made him an Irishman. And people were really not happy with me. So
I do get it. I have some fun with names sometimes, too, because a few years ago I was in Ireland and I toured Guinness Brewery and I got talking to one of the brewers there and he was telling me they had like 8 people named Daniel Olson who worked in the brewery. And because everybody has the same name, everybody has to have nicknames. And when I wrote Last Call, it was about a community where there were a number of guys named Ray in the community. I got researching into that, talking a little about it. One guy they called Oktoberfest Ray because he didn't go out until after the harvest. What does Oct mean in German? 8, right? They called him Ray 8 and eventually just Rate. Another guy, Ray Loescheider, had the unfortunate moniker when Jennifer Lopez changed her name to J-Lo. They just called him Ray-Lo. My favorite guy was a guy they called Ray Ray, and so I used a story from him in the book. He was one of those guys who, first of all, they called him Ray Ray because he repeated everything he said. But he'd get in the bar, give me a beer, gotta go. And he just covered with grease and always had this. And he'd see somebody in the bar, if the bartenders are busy, with a full 16-ounce glass of beer and say, hey, you know, there's a trick I can do. I can drink a full 16-ounce glass of beer in one swallow. And they'd have this conversation. That's not possible. Nobody can do that. And Ray would say, look, I don't want to take your money. Let's bet a quarter. All right. And so he'd pick up that glass of beer. It'd take him about a dozen swallows. He'd empty it, set the empty glass on the bar and say, oh, you're right. Give him a quarter, walk away. And so... I like using those real stories of people sometimes here and there in books. Yeah.
We'll be back for more Masters of Mystery after a word from our sponsors.
In Flanders Fields is one of the most notable poems written during World War I, perhaps even the most famous war poem of all time. Canadian physician and Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae wrote it on 3rd May of 1915, after he witnessed the death of his friend, Lieutenant Alex Helmer, 22 years old, the day before.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe, to you from failing hands we throw, the torch be yours to hold it high, if ye break faith with us who die. We shall not sleep, though poppies grow, in Flanders Fields.
In Flanders Fields was first published in December 1915. Within months, the poem came to symbolize the sacrifices of all those who were fighting for in the First World War. Today, the poem continues to be part of the memorial ceremonies around the world.
Hi everyone, Seth here from Seth Faces the Music. You know, being the host of the award-winning second greatest radio show in the state of Wisconsin can be a lot of work. I have to come up with new themes all the time. So in the interest of clarity, here are some topics I will not be using in upcoming episodes.
Mittens, tinfoil, gastric bypass surgery, window treatments, 17th century Japanese art, outhouses, bowler hats, spam, clog dancing.
Seth Faces the Music, every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. only on WFHR.
An unsuspecting driver at a Milwaukee barbershop.
I got an apprentice here shadowing me. I'm going to put this hot towel on, man. About a good 3 minutes, all right?
The apprentice is Donald Driver.
So when you come here, you drive?
Yes.
Your car got seatbelts?
Yeah.
You wear them?
No.
Okay, but why not?
I don't want to.
But do you know you can get a ticket for that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you a ticket. Bet you wish you buckle up now.
Oh, my God.
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Take it, click it. There you go.
Click it or take it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience, where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Hey, everybody. Glad you could join us. I'm Tim Hubbelt, better known as the Polka Guy, on the Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show.
Join Tim every Saturday and Sunday for a great variety of polkas, waltzes, and more. Wake up at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning to get the weekend started on the right foot, then enjoy a lively Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. Same great show, two different times, one fun weekend. The Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show, 7 a.m. Saturdays and 1 p.m. Sundays, only on WFHR, locally grown radio.
As seasons change and years fly by, one thing remains consistent. Old Dutch. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Upper Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or simply treating yourself, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Welcome back. It's time to rejoin Masters of Mystery.
So I would like to get back to forensics. How have forensics changed in your books?
There's so many wonderful things that we're able to do now. For example, here's a Minnesota forensic question. How do you get a footprint out of snow? You know, on a gravel road, you pour plaster, spray beeswax, one thin layer after another until it gets thick enough. There's actually a program called Soulmate. You can put any shoe print in, and it will tell you the size and make of any shoe. And remember the old movies? If someone had written something in a notebook and torn it off, they'd take pencil, go over it, and try to see. Now they have a machine called an electrostatic detection apparatus. You can put a stack of Post-its in there with all the notes ripped off, and it will tell you what was written on every note by different levels of minute indentations in the paper. And so there's all kinds of wonderful stuff. But our audience is also getting smarter because they're watching so many investigative shows. So, like, people used to leave gloves at crime scenes. They don't anymore because now they know you can get fingerprints from the inside of them.
Frank, repeat the question, would you?
Okay, what is my favorite most difficult book? Actually, the last couple, Scandal of Vandals in the Sun. And part of it is, you're always excited about the newest project, you know. I get fired up about it, and I like getting it out there. And just, I talked to so many people who were involved in the cases. If any of you have watched Fargo, that show wasn't based on this scene. But if you remember that brutal assault on the woman right at the beginning, that was based on this case. I always tell people there's a dozen things that are going to happen in every investigation that you can't predict. And this was one of them. So you have this guy who breaks in the house, a hitman, turns a gun on her, it jams, and she's in the tub, there's a big fight, he pistol whips her, she gets away, instead of running out of the house naked, she goes in the bedroom to get a robe, he catches up to her, there's a fight, they fall down the stairs, he stabs her with a knife, and eventually when he believes she's dead, he goes to the bathroom, washes hands, comes back, and she's gone. And that's true to the case. She makes it. Gets to the first house. They don't answer the door because they think it's a salesman. The next two aren't home. She collapses on the porch of the fourth home. The guy now who didn't anticipate this is now covered in blood. He has to walk two blocks to his car. This happened at 9 a.m. in a wealthy area of the cities, and nobody saw either of them. You know, nobody was in their yard. Nobody was answering the door. Nobody was looking out the window. That you have weird things that happen in cases like that sometimes that are just difficult to explain. So yeah, but when you read some of this stuff, it just seems like that can't be true, but it is, you know. That, or even talking to Jeff Thompson, the son, who said that mom gets attacked, my aunt pulls us out of school, he's the oldest, he has three younger sisters, brings us to her house and turns the TV on and starts calling people. He said all of a sudden, breaking news, close up on their house, they see their mom getting hauled out in a stretcher. He said, my aunt sees that, shuts the TV off. She didn't know what to do with them, so she brought them all back to school. And he said, at 2:30 in the afternoon, the principal pulled me out of class and said, your mom just died. And when the editor looked at it, she said, well, you can't put that in there. Nobody will believe that. I said, okay, that's what happened, though, you know, that you have stuff like that that happens.
Do we have any questions from the audience?
You can hold the mic, but it doesn't work.
So we've been having a lovely discussion here at our table. We've all been discussing serial killers. So it's a two-part question. One, why are women in particular fascinated by serial killers? And who is your favorite serial killer, which is the topic of discussion that we've been having all night?
Me, I don't know that I have a favorite serial killer just because of the side I'm on. That, as a matter of fact, I think one of the problems, there were seven times as many serial killers in the 1980s as there are today. And the reason is because we treated them like rock stars. And I hate that. Mm-hmm. The reality of these people are horrible. Why is there such a fascination? That's a good question. What always interests me is that these are the guys that always have women writing to them in prison. And even on a lower level, that it's like the most abusive guys always have, they're living with a woman a week after they're released from prison, where a lot of better people aren't. For whatever reason, there seems to be kind of an offender-victim attraction in a lot of those cases, or at least curiosity, and it's that people want to save or change somebody.
Sort of Stockholm syndrome from a distance.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Well, yeah. And it's interesting because I actually spoke to a woman who was writing to a serial killer. And one of the things she said that it was helping her deal with her own victimization, and she was safe because he was never getting out of prison. I got to share this with you just as long as we're talking about questions. And I don't want this to keep anybody from asking questions, but I was speaking in an auditorium in Stillwater, and I asked, anybody have any questions? And this woman raised her hand and said, hey, did you hear about that perv in Minneapolis who's breaking into houses and like rubbing women's feet and sucking on their toes when they're sleeping? And I said, actually, I did the assessment in that case, so I can't talk about it. And she says, I'd have paid that guy $200.
That's great. Any other questions? Oh, right behind you.
I'm just curious what you think about the Menendez brothers.
Guilty. That I think if they didn't have a lot of money, they wouldn't be on television.
Right. Yep.
This is for Betty. Did La Cava serve any time in prison for his work with Capone? Was he complicit as an accountant, or was he kind of coerced into it or forced into it or anything like that? What was his outcome of the whole case and everything?
Well, I think that Louis LaCava and Al Capone were boyhood friends in Manhattan. I know that when Al Capone and his family, and he moved the whole family to Chicago at the same time, Louis LaCava moved his whole family to Chicago at the same time. So that's where I get the idea that they had a long relationship. So Louis LaCava, I think, first was a button man for Al Capone, got promoted to lieutenant. There's a big, several articles in the Chicago papers about a big feud that took place between Al Capone and Louis LaCava during a 1924 election when Al Capone charged Louis LaCava with getting his man into office, and he failed. The headlines in the paper said, Al Capone threatens LaCava to leave Chicago and never return for fear of death. So that was their relationship. I think at that point, Louis LaCava migrated from being a lieutenant to a bookkeeper. They reasoned that the people in the organization convinced Capone that Louis LaCava was really good with numbers. Let him stay and just be your bookkeeper. But if you're a bookkeeper for one mob boss, guess what? You're a bookkeeper for other mob bosses. And so when Louis LaCava was subpoenaed and forced to testify at Capone's trial, he was subsequently forced to testify at Johnny Turillo's trial. He went to prison, and others in the mafia world. I think he was a willing participant.
But he never did jail time.
He never did jail time, although, you know, in 1968, he built a house in my hometown on the north end of town. He apparently didn't feel safe. He built a panic room in that house. All the doors and windows had quadruple locks. Even the garbage cans had locks on them, and the garbage people were given a key to access and remove the garbage weekly. So He never felt safe again.
Yeah, they get some amazing deals. Sammy the Bull, who testified against John Gotti, had killed 19 people, and they let all that go to testify if he'd testify against Gotti.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he actually went to prison on a violation for helping his son sell meth. And he was mad that they sent him on that. He said, what? I killed 19 people and I got to walk on that. You know, which is ridiculous. Yeah.
Yep. Any other questions?
Did you ever interview anyone, either of you, and you thought or knew they were innocent?
Yes. There was a case, for example, that I thought the person was innocent when they were convicted. They didn't ask me to testify. I have to be subpoenaed to testify. And then when they got released, she came to me for counseling, and we gave her a lie detector test, and she passed it. But she had a son who was a psychopath who testified against her, and they didn't realize it, how damaged she was at the time, because when he testified against her, he was only a teenager, but I could see he was a problem. And I've had other situations. And sometimes people plead guilty to things they're not guilty of because they've done other horrible things, which is interesting.
So I know that, how do I say this? So lots of mafia people, allegedly, they were really impoverished growing up. They started with making their own booze. Pretty soon somebody approached them and offered them a lot of money to kill someone, and they did it. And then they did it again and again. So what is there one... Can you say that about the majority of the people that you come in contact with, that there's that motivation to get rich or to get powerful?
Well,
or
I do say psychopaths are made, not born. Yeah. That they all have horrible histories, and that you see that. With, this is why profiling works, because people act out their trauma. Think about those beginning psych classes where they talk about trust versus mistrust, and you see this violent assault on a woman. You can already assume neglectful mother, absent father, that there's, you just, the profile of all the stuff that just plays out. I want to share Once Upon a Crime is sharing our books here. Thank you, Devin. And selling
yes,
our books if
you.
People are interested after. Other thoughts?
Any further questions?
Yes.
One.
So I was wondering, with your books becoming bigger, have you ever had like a bad reaction from like former inmates that you've interviewed? When you go into an interview, somebody knows about your books. Have you ever?
I've had bad reactions from people I've interviewed that have nothing to do with my books. That, you know, when people threaten to kill me or sue me, I just say, get in line. But generally, no. And what's interesting about it is they'd still rather be talked about, you know, even if it's bad, rather have the publicity than no publicity. Before I'm done, I just have to share this. Because when you interview people, people misuse statements all the time. And I just love to share at least one of these every time I'm talking. So you've all heard the saying, work like you don't need the money, dance like nobody's watching. I was interviewing a young woman. She said, yep, my mom always said, dance like you don't need the money. It's a whole different visual there.
And on that note... Let's give a big round of applause to our guest authors this evening, Frank Lever, Betty Pasek.
Well, that's it for Masters of Mystery this month, folks. Thanks for listening, and please come back next month for another conversation as we once again converse with Minnesota's most celebrated mystery writers. Until then, please support your local bookstore, and in particular, buy the books of the authors who have entertained us tonight.
It's no mystery where you find the best munchies. It's under the Old Dutch windmill at your favorite snack store. For over 90 years, Old Dutch Foods has proudly delivered taste sensations to families throughout the Midwest. Old Dutch is a Minnesota-made, family-owned company committed to quality and flavor that brings everyone together. Whether you're enjoying a gathering with loved ones or reading your favorite mystery, Old Dutch snacks make every moment special. Join us in celebrating the flavors that have delighted loyal fans for generations. Old Dutch. Quality lives here.
Our guest authors take their final bows. The riddles have been unraveled. The cases are closed. This has been Masters of Mystery, brought to you by Old Dutch Foods. Signing off until next month, when we will once again dissect the minds behind the murders.
Mom!
Mommy, how come I can't sit in the front seat?
Because I love you and you're just not ready yet.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Love protects. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. President Trump says he'll hold off on imposing a hefty tariff on EU goods until July 9th after a call with the head of the European Commission.
She asked for an extension on the June 1st date. And she said she wants to get down to serious negotiation because I've told you specifically, haven't I told anybody that would listen? They have to do that.
The president also says he's not happy with Russian President Vladimir Putin for continued bombings of Ukraine and posted that an attempt to conquer all of the country will be Russia's downfall.
He's killing a lot of people. I don't know what's wrong with him. What the hell happened to him, right? He's killing a lot of people. I'm not happy about that.
Connecticut Democratic Congressman Jim Himes on CBS's Face the Nation.
For this guy who considers himself the master of the deal, maximize the leverage of the West so that we can bring this